Profile interview.
Professor Malgaburu William Makoba is my guest, and he joins me now on the line. Prof, it has been a long time coming, and finally the moment has come.
Thank you very much, Aubrey. You're so correct. Yeah, we've been threatening to talk to each other, but at long last, it's happening. Except that I'm very far away from where you are today. Yeah,
I know, Prof. There'll be many, many occasions for us to get together and talk, and I'm still looking for that moment where I can shake your hand and talk to you about things pertinent. So, so you wrote a tell-all memoir, and I must confess and say to you, I haven't read it, Prof. I have not yet read it. But that's probably why you and I need to get together for another conversation to talk specifically about the book. And the title of the book is Leadership for Transformation Since the Dawn of South Africa's Democracy, an Insider's View. I'm interested in this insider's view. Why? Why did you add that little caveat?
Because I was fortunate, I think, to serve and work with some of the most important decision makers of this new democracy, starting with Nelson Mandela, coming with Thabo Mbeki, Jacob Zuma, Cyril Ramaphosa, and about 25 cabinet ministers that I served and advised and interacted with very closely at a very high level. So I have been part of that. And secondly, that I was also fortunate to serve in leadership position myself as Deputy Vice Chancellor, President of the Medical Research Council, Vice Chancellor of the University of Natal and KwaZulu-Natal, and a member of the Data Safety Monitoring for the U.S. government during the coronavirus vaccine development, leading to the so-called 5 approved vaccines that have been used worldwide.
Yeah. So, but you consider yourself an insider of, I suppose, that fraternity of leaders and leadership?
I consider myself an insider of the people who midwife the new democracy of South Africa, because I work with them very, very closely and at very senior position. Yeah.
How do you think we did? How do you think we've done so far as a country, but also as the leadership of that country since the dawn of democracy? How do you think we've done thus far, Prof?
Well, fortunately, I came back to South Africa in August 1994, and that's why I released this book, in August. Or just after August, and what has happened during this period where I had this fortune to be working with very important decision makers, I observed that our country started with enthusiasm, with hope, and with energy, of course, led by a very iconic leader. Followed by another sort of like a very dedicated, committed president, Thabo Mbeki. And when you look at that phase, I think we seem to be on an upward trajectory, as some people call it. And then we had, the Jacob Zuma era with Cyril, and now it was followed by Cyril, and this has been just a downward spiral. So we've had these two phases, but I don't capture it as such. I just recognize that during the Mandela era and the Mbeki era, something was happening that was positive. And during the Zuma and the Ramaphosa era, it has been a total disaster.
You say that you worked with decision makers, and I imagine you mean leaders at the highest level of governance in various aspects of South Africanness. I want to talk a little bit about the presidents that you've worked under. Were they decision makers? Develop that question a little bit further. Were they decision makers, or were they the conduits for a particular set of ideas at a particular time that were going to happen, whether they were there or not?
No, I think they made decisions. That's why the country moved in a particular direction under each one of them, because they made decisions. Even if they were receiving information from everywhere, when the buck stops with you, you make that decision that actually often changes or enhances or takes away from where the country was going in terms of direction. So I make the point that presidents are appointed to make decisions, not to bargain. They do listen to people who give them ideas, but at the end of the day, it's like being a doctor. You know, you receive all the information about the history and everything like that, but you have to decide that I'm going to cut this person, I'm going to remove that. That's the decision you make, and you are a decision maker. So I use that word in that context.
Right.
That the people that I work with made decisions that led to a particular trajectory, and in which you can assess it either through the economy or through the education or through the people they appointed. You can see that this was a group of people that knew what they were doing. As you can see that now we have a group of people who don't know what they're doing, but nevertheless, they occupy those positions. And that's why we're in a mess.
Phew. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about that phase between or during the time of former President Nelson Mandela and then later former President Thabo Mbeki. What was it, in your opinion, about that era that gave us the upward trajectory that you're talking about? And what are your indicators for that upward trajectory?
Okay, let me start with one big indicator. When Mandela and Mbeki came in 1994, the economy of South Africa was stagnant. We were owing a lot of money to, you know, to international agencies and so forth. So they inherited a broke country. And they took that broke country to ensure that the economy was growing. And by the time Mbeki was there, our economy was growing around 5%, 6% or so. So that's one indicator. Now, the difference between Mbeki and Nelson Mandela, of course, Nelson Mandela was an icon. Everybody knew that he made decisions. And he often said that you can tell me what you want to do. At the end of the day, the buck stops with me and I'm going to make the decision. And he did that quite effectively. But more importantly, Mandela's real legacy was this concept of reconciliation in order to transform the country. He thought that if we reconcile the country from a divided past, we will then have a cohesive society that will transform the country. He was partly responsible, I think, for laying down the foundations of the constitution, a human rights-based constitution. And then he was followed by Mbeki, who thought the other way, right? If he transformed the country, it will unite. And he made transformation his mantra, and he set up almost like a business CEO, following up everything everywhere to ensure that institutions were functioning, they were functioning well. You know, I know Mbeki, if Mbeki wanted something from you, he would chase you until he gets it. And if he said, I'll respond to you, he responded in time. He never wasted any time. But he drove the country to unite through transformation, while Mandela wanted to transform it through reconciliation. But both of them inherited, as I say, a broke country. Now, from there, you had two people who inherited almost like a wealthy country and ran it down.
We'll talk about those two individuals in a few moments' time.
Okay.
But you were part of that leadership. In fact, you've served under all the presidents of post-apartheid South Africa?
No, except Kgalema Motlanthe.
Except Kgalema Motlanthe. Yes, of course. Except
yes, Kgalema Motlanthe. I did it. Yeah.
What was your understanding of your service? Did you? I mean, fundamentally, if I'm correct, Prof, you're a physician, right?
Yes.
And of course you've done other things. You are qualified in many other things. But the people out in Limpopo know that you're a doctor. If I'm sick, I can go to Professor Malegaburu Makoba, and he'll give me a Panado, and he'll know what to do with me. But what was your, when you entered this moment of service? What were you entering this moment of service as, to achieve what? You knew, or perhaps maybe it's a matter of hindsight, you knew what the leader of the country's vision was at that particular time, and you obviously bought into it, and that's why you assisted. But what was your inspiration? What were you entering this project of either reconciliation or transformation as, to do what ultimately? I'm talking about you, the individual.
Yeah, you see, Aubrey, when I was in the UK, I had a permanent position up until 2019 as a reader at the Royal Postgraduate Medical School. Now, this is the place where every doctor wants to be in the Commonwealth. And I was just one of 45 people that were permanently employed by this school. And when the old man was released, I had the opportunity to meet with him in his office here in South Africa. And he said to me, William, as he called me, I'm building a new country that we have all struggled for. And I would like you to come back and be part of building this country. And you can decide how you want to play that role, but I would like you to come back. And I would ensure that obviously there are positions that you are able to go into and provide us with some ideas. Because I think over a long time, people did know that I enjoy research, I enjoy investigations quietly, and I'm able to write reasonable ideas and papers. And so when I got back, one of the things that I did was I had a column in the Star where I used to write how I believed the country should change and become a new democracy. Obviously, that was inspired by the old man, and he used to read that, and he used to make sure that members of his cabinet read what I wrote. In fact, some of them used to say, don't write too much because you are giving us too much
money. You know? Yes.
The three people who read ferociously what I wrote was Kada Asmal, Mangosuthu Buthelezi, and Trevor Manuel. So, I mean, in the cabinet, the so-called the cabinet of national unity. And then when Thabo took over from Mandela, I identified with actually Thabo's vision and clarity of I am an African and I want to, you know, to be the person I am in this globalizing world. And I wrote a lot of articles and we exchanged a lot of ideas. I used to work with a lot of his team, like, for example, the late Ronnie Mamwepa, Ntenteni, you know, people who advised him, and some of the so-called kitchen cabinet of Thabo Mbeki, including the late Issop Bahat. You know, remember, Thabo Mbeki is known for having championed the African Renaissance.
Yeah.
I was the person who organized the first African Renaissance in the country under the guidance of Thabo Mbeki. And I invited a lot of scholars from all over the world. And actually, Thabo Mbeki decided during that conference to set up his office at the place of the conference so that he could almost attend everything. So I was intimately involved with him and exchanging ideas, as I say, with his team, because I really supported his view of the African Renaissance and of the clarity of I am an African vision.
So you entered the service, the civil service, the public service, not necessarily as a physician, but as a thought leader,
as an
inspirer of certain ideas that were in line with the fundamental sort of inspirations of the apex leaders of the time.
That's correct. I was just a, I never wanted to be a politician in my life, and I've never been one. But I do enjoy playing with ideas and seeing how ideas are associated and how they can be simplified in such a manner that they give simple messages. In fact, this has been maybe the story of my life. Even in science, I've often taken complex issues and simplified them for the betterment of science and young scientists to understand that these complexities that they see are actually governed by very simple rules.
Yeah.
And my most fundamental contribution to science has been to simplify some of the complexities of science.
Prof, take me back to your childhood. Where did you grow up? Where were you born?
Born where I am right now, in my father's house here in Skunot, in Skukuriland.
Mm. And tell me about your upbringing. You were obviously a bright child. I mean, I've heard a lot of people talking about that. Tell me about some of the seminal moments that shaped the person that became Professor Malegapuru Makob.
Well, I think one of the seminal, I think, issues that maybe shaped my life, I can think of a couple, but I'll just list them. I used to be a shepherd, and I looked after my father's goats and sheep, and I used to spend my time alone, wandering, the field, and in deep thought, and assessing how things and how nature and animals and human beings relate to each other. This was just because of the loneliness that I spent with my goats and sheep. I think that was one dimension. The next dimension was that when I was a youngster at about the age of 11, my school principal, who was the father of Nukaning, the one who used to be in Radio Bantu, Mohobo Boy Nukaning, who lived in Mamelodi somewhere, called my parents and myself. I was 11 years old. And he said to my parents, I have taught many children in my life as a teacher, and this is the best child I've ever taught, and I don't think anybody will ever beat him. It doesn't mean there are no brighter children than him, but he will, in the end, in the long term, he will prevail. And he said to my parents, look after him. I was there, and of course, my parents had already made that decision, because one time they were talking amongst themselves. They said to them, they were talking and they didn't know that I could hear. And they said, you know, this is a special child. Let's allow him to develop the way he wants to develop. So I always had that kind of relationship with my parents. I understood that. And I just made use of it and took advantage of it. So when I was doing my primary school, and I got the highest marks in primary school, people said, well, after all, his father is the school principal. He has stolen papers for him and so forth. And then my dad says, my boy, I don't want you in this district of Skukuni. You must move and go back to Petersburg. Actually, I grew up in Petersburg. So my dad took me to Huiti. When I arrived in Huiti, at the end of March, the late Mrs. Kware, who was the first woman to become president of the Black People's Convention, at the end of March, came to me and said, I have come to the conclusion that we're wasting your time in this Form 1 class. And I think you need to prepare yourself so that you can go into the Form 2 class. And I said, it's going to be a difficult thing for me because when I was in primary school, my Mr. Nkane wanted me to write Standard 6 when I was in Standard 4. And my father said no. I said, I think you'd have to negotiate with my dad. And of course, she said, no, I'll do everything. And I said, and also, I don't want to be promoted alone. It will, and I'll stick like a sore thumb in the school. And either you get a positive response or you get rejected by everybody. So I requested the late Ms. Quaret and the principal to set up a criteria that would allow people to be promoted at the high school. When they went to the district inspector, the inspector said, we've never done that. And then Ms. Quaret said, well, if we have never done it, it's about time we can experiment and try it. So a group of about six of us were then promoted. So those are just the things that shaped my life.
Yep.
And, I grew up confident. I never had doubts about my abilities. And, I mean, even when I arrived at Oxford, in the late 70s, one of the professors said to his friend that he had never seen a genius like this. But that's, those are things that obviously they inspire you.
Yeah.
But I had this other side of me, being South African and being part of the Biko era, the Mandela era of black consciousness and so forth. And I was very much aware of that. And I wanted to participate in that. But I didn't want to participate in the manner of raising my hands, Amanda, and doing all kinds of stuff. I wanted to participate and contribute in the manner where I think it played to my strengths.
Yeah, it's a big conversation at the moment. there's some people who think that if you've got a keen interest in certain current affairs issues, then you should enter politics. And I hold the view that not everybody must be a politician. I think that you can make a contribution with the strengths that you have, with the resourcing that you have, and not everybody has to be a politician. But let me go back, Prof, to the idea of being a thought leader. Fundamentally, you were a physician, but you were a thought leader interested in other things. What other things did you excel in other than, the field of medicine? You spent 13 years in the UK working there. But what were some of the other things that you excelled in other than medicine?
I don't know whether I couldn't be measured in all of this, but I know that I love music. So I never played an instrument, but I'm a very good listener of music.
Yep.
And I listen to music all along, in every culture I enjoy the music. But it's because every time I listen to a music playing, I ask myself, what am I listening here in this record that is playing? Is it am I listening to the lyrics? Am I listening to the composition? Am I doing this? And everywhere I have stayed, Aubrey, before I settle into a house, I get experts in music to come and set up my music system so that it plays music to the way that I want to understand.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call that excellent, but I'm detailed in that way. In my passions, I'm very detailed about that. Yeah.
Could that be the thing with you, that you've always been a very, very astute person as far as detail is concerned? You know, most of us like ideas, but we don't necessarily delve too much into the detail of stuff. Could that be the abiding sort of differentiation factor for Professor Makgoba to say that he's a man who loves detail?
Well, I was born by a mother who was obsessionally detailed. So I learned that from my mother. That's a real thing. That my mother had three teachers. She loved details. She had a very strong memory. And my mother knew how to associate ideas. And I picked that up from her. So if you had to characterize me, it is true that I love details. I've got a very long memory. I can remember things from the time when I was 3 years old. I can remember this. I can remember not only the thing, but I can remember when, in terms of time.
What kind of music do you like, Prof?
Well, as I say, I like all types of music.
Hip-hop?
But I like all types of music. But as I say, I grew up in the era of the Hugh Masekela, the Miriam Makeba's, you know, and so forth. So the Stevie Wonder's, you know, that kind of soul music, jazz.
Yeah.
But more soul than jazz.
Yeah. Yeah. So it appears to me that, and help me if I'm wrong, but it appears to me that you are the kind of person that loved the science of science, but there was also a very soulful, passionate side of you that that was able to implement the science of science in a particular way, and dare I say, passionately and humanely.
I think that is correct, and I'll support this by two things. When I was at Oxford, my PhD supervisor gave an interview about me to one of the leading science journals, and he described me as a scientist with a social conscience, who always wanted to do something for his people. That was his description. And then when I went to the National Institute of Health, my boss there, Dr. Stephen Shaw, used the same phrases to describe me, and they had never spoken about me, the two of them. So I assume that they saw something in me that they felt it was just more than science to me. In fact, my boss at the NIH used to say, you know, if you could just only focus on the science and stop attending ANC or rallies in downtown Washington, I'm sure you'd be one of the people to win the Nobel Prize in Medicine.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the moments that that would have challenged you in your service of South Africa under various presidents. And I must be honest to you that the first time I started noticing and understanding that there's a man by the name of Professor Makgoba was during that AIDS moment where policies were being developed as a result of the ravaging nature of HIV and AIDS at that particular time. Tell me about that time, Prof. It sounds to me that it was a particularly challenging time.
Well, yes, it was a challenging time because, first of all, we were dealing with a major epidemic, an epidemic that whose details I understood a little bit better than many people at the time. And the president of the country and the minister of health of the time decided to take a view that I could not relate to. But then, because politics dominates societies that are in development, and by that I mean developing nations, in developing nations, politicians are believed more than scientists. That's a common feature and a common history of development. Because politicians bring liberations and so forth, scientists are just, recluse people who sit and write papers that people hardly understand. So I think it was when I think the president and the minister questioned, I think, the causality of AIDS, it created a confusion in society. And of course, it couldn't be backed up by the science as I knew and understood it. And I wanted to articulate the scientific aspect of this this disease. And obviously, because of the view that I was articulating was contrary to that of the state president and the minister, it became, it blew up into what people called a controversy. There's no doubt that the minister and the president did not understand, I think, the pathophysiology of HIV/AIDS. But you can't acquire to be a scientist simply because you are the president of the country. You've got to study science. And I can't become the president of our country because I'm a scientist. I must be a politician. These two things are quite distinct. But lots of people were frightened. Lots of doctors were signing certificates and hiding the cause of the cause of death because they were terrified about that they didn't want to be in the eye of the political thinking of the time.
Yeah.
And 350,000 people died in that era. And today we go and criticize Israel, rightly, when 30,000 people have died, a group of people. We were responsible for 350,000 people because of the political choices that we made.
Prof, those of us who were sort of pipsqueaks at the time heard, phrases like, how can a syndrome cause this? What were the issues?
That was part of the what I call scientific virginity. They didn't understand the science. There are many syndromes that are caused by viruses in medicine. They're all well described. So it's not surprising that
I'm wanting to get educated here because we remember, or at least I remember the controversy, but I would argue that many of us didn't understand the scientific debate. It very, 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 very succinctly, what were the issues at that time?
I think the main issue was of denial. I think, Aubrey, that the liberation movements, and I use that movement carefully because it's not only the ANC. They had brought freedom to our country. And they brought this freedom together with a serious pandemic. And there's a very simple epidemiological reason for that, is that when South Africa was under apartheid, its borders were locked because, the Afrikaners were terrified of any African that jumped the border and came into South Africa. They saw them as, communists and so forth coming to influence the other Africans that they want to control. And then when we unbanned the movements and people started to come back, people came back from the countries where they had located themselves, and the prevalences of HIV/AIDS in those countries, except for Angola, was much higher than here in South Africa. So we simply inherited a group of people that, had higher prevalences than the locals that were here. And we gave this virus 10 years to seed into the population. And it just exploded after 10 years.
because of that denialism?
Because of the denialism that
what was being denied?
Well, what was being denied was fundamentally that the virus causes this syndrome. That's the one. Of course, the deeper denial was that clearly people in that leadership realized that they had brought two things together: freedom and a pandemic that was going to destroy the freedom.
And what were those the terms of, or were those the issues of the disagreement with you and the minister at the time?
Because
if you remember, Prof, the conversation was, the intellectuals, both Professor Makhoba, are anti-African remedies. Minister Manto Shabalala Msimang was coming up with the African potato and Anya and all of that stuff. And the real conversation became, it's people like Makhoba who studied in England and did all of these wonderful things that were anti-African approaches to pathologies and so forth. So we lost the scientific conversation. And it became really couched in this other conversation that really didn't reveal the real science issues. Very, very quickly, Prof, because I want to move on to something. So what were the issues, really? What was the issue here?
The issue was that we had a political leadership that wanted to impose itself on something that they understood very little about. But it was actually a very frightening but a very frightened political leadership. And if you were to read generally what I wrote, I never actually, had a direct confrontation or anything like that. What I did, and I was very careful, that I will only put the scientific message out there as I know it. Just like when I co-edited the Durban Declaration about the causation of AIDS, and we had over 5,000 scientists who had worked in the field signing this sort of thing. So it was really just that misunderstanding. But
what was the misunderstanding? Did President Thabo Mbeki and the minister believe that AIDS, HIV does not cause AIDS? What was their fundamental doctrine?
That was the interpretation that they were doing, because if you didn't believe that HIV causes AIDS, then there was no need even to do the test that they were doing, because the test would not be testing anything that is of significance. You didn't believe the statistics of the causes of death, because at the time the controversy was, what is the leading cause of death in South Africa? Was it a motor car accident? Trauma, or was it HIV/AIDS, or was it TB? All those sorts of things like
and
that.
And what did the data say?
The data said at the time when I was president of the MRC, HIV/AIDS was the leading cause of death. And the government of the day, under the president and the minister, said trauma and accidents were the leading cause of death in South Africa.
Because they were afraid that the narrative may emerge that it was the re-entry of exiles back into South Africa that carried the virus.
I think that's a reasonable interpretation. Yes,
Prof. Let's move on. But you stay in civil service. You stayed. Somebody would have said, I can go anywhere in the world. I could. You stayed. Why?
Because as I said, all my mentors knew that I have a social conscience to serve people. That is what made me do medicine in the first instance. I mean, I wasn't the sort of physician who spent most of his time I suppose, caring for patients because I was in the research and so forth. But I wanted my science to have an impact in the social understanding of disease and of patients. And that's why I kept being in the public service. And firstly, maybe just to say, you know, my dad was a school principal. And my dad always emphasized public service. So I never wanted to go into private practice. I thought that I would be able to contribute playing the science that I knew to the best of my advantage. That's why I stayed in public service, yeah. And that's why I welcome the idea of, I think, interacting and influencing these leaders that were shaping the, you know, the future of our country.
We had more controversies that emanated from the health sector, the public health sector, and you were involved in the Life Estimeni tragedy as part of the ombuds team.
Yes.
Again, it appears that it was politics over science that was the cause of that situation.
Correct. It was politicians ignoring expert science advice.
That issue is still unresolved in as much as the issue of the gravity of losing 350,000 people to the ignorances and the allure of political interpretations to issues that ought to be dealt with scientifically.
Yeah.
We had people die in the most gruesome ways. I got to tell you this, Prof. It was the one thing that made me weep. In fact, I remember weeping on air when the Life Estimeni situation happened, because, you know, the people that perished in the most undignified ways in that saga were people that were not a very powerful constituency.
Yeah, they were all helpless, vulnerable people that we needed to take care of, and we didn't do so. But, you know, just to illustrate the point, Aubrey, in 1990, South Africa and Thailand, the prevalence of HIV in South Africa and Thailand was 0.2% in both countries. After 10 years, the prevalence of HIV in Thailand was 2%, and in South Africa it was 30%. Hmm. So it had gone 150 times, and it had gone 10 times in Thailand. And how do you explain that?
Then we had the issue of Eskom.
Yeah.
You were the chairperson of Eskom for a certain amount of time. and dare I say, and that's when you and I started to talk, because I was asking you some pointed questions in private conversations. Once again, it seems to me like we have the Eskom problem.
Yeah.
Precisely because science was ignored.
Yeah. Because politicians think that they there is something in German called Uber Alles. They think they can do everything.
So characterize for me what the problem of Eskom was, is, and continues to be.
It's political meddling. And people who do this political meddling hardly understand the science of electricity generation and its transmission and distribution. I mean, they get their education by briefing and think that they can suddenly become electrical engineers. I mean, it just doesn't work that way in science.
Did you fail at Eskom? Did you fail as a board?
Well, I was removed. I didn't fail.
Had you stayed, do you think that your board would have been able to solve the problems that we are continuing to experience now with unabated load shedding?
Well, my belief, and it's still my belief, that the problem of Eskom is going to be solved by scientists and not by politicians. And part of the reason why the board that I chaired laid down the foundation for what is called the president's action plan. That plan was laid by the board that I chaired with Andre de Reiter. Of course, it has been improved by the input that I think the president took, but the foundations of that, the fundamentals of that, this so-called presidential action plan, energy action plan, was devised by ourselves. So I think over time, with the Minister of Electricity and with the new ESCOM CEO, I think over time, the problem would be dealt with. Yeah.
What do you make of assertions that are doing the rounds that the problems of ESCOM are designed and deliberately deliberately made to be so in order to usher in a new industry of renewable energy sources?
No, I don't buy that story. Neither do I buy the story that our government is determined to privatize ESCOM. I don't buy those two things. I think I've been intimately involved. I don't believe that renewable energies are being brought in because they are the fashion of the modern era. I think the world globally is moving in that direction, and we will only be behind if we are not trying to be ahead of everybody. You know, there is a saying in science, you are not good enough if you are second best. In science, you try to be the first, the best.
Prof, we've got 3 minutes. And in this 3 minutes, I want to hear your thoughts about two individuals, Jacob Zuma and Cyril Ramaphosa. Most of the problems you and I have spoken about emanate from the era of Thabo Mbeki. The issue of HIV/AIDS denialism that killed 350,000 people. The life is a Temeni situation, perhaps in the Jacob Zuma era of things, but the load shedding reality also comes from the Thabo Mbeki era. How can we say that Jacob Zuma and Cyril Ramaphosa were perhaps less than successful, given the realities that they inherited from their predecessor Thabo Mbeki?
Well, you don't judge a president by what they inherited. You judge a president by how they solve what they have inherited. Because by its very nature, to be a president or to be a leader, you inherit something, the good and the bad. So we're not going to judge you by your inheritance. We judge you by what you do. And let's take, for example, the HIV/AIDS. I mean, obviously, Zuma did solve the HIV/AIDS by establishing the largest ARV program in the world, according to the WHO. So he did try and counter that, and that program is very successful. It has reduced, it has improved the life expectancy of South Africans. So he has done something quite good. I think the problem with Cyril is, remember that he was actually appointed by Jacob Zuma
to head up the war room, yeah?
Yeah, to be the first minister of electricity. And he didn't seem to take advantage of that, and it just gotten worse and worse. So there are two scenarios where you inherit something and you solve it, and then where you inherit something and you simply fail and it gets worse.
Were they just bad leaders?
Just what?
Were they just bad leaders, these two?
They are worse than bad.
Yo, Prof, you see that you and I need to have a conversation around the book specifically. I mean, today it was about you, but I want to have the conversation with you about the book. So can we book a time soon for the conversation around the book, Leadership for Transformation Since the Dawn of South Africa's Democracy, an Insider's View? Will you join me, Prof?
Well, you know, Aubrey, I'm retired, so I've got all the time.
Professor Malegaburu Makoba, it was great talking.